deserves, except the drunks, and they laugh too much. After which he embarks on his description. At daybreak, light breaths of air fan the still empty streets. At this hour, between the night's victims and the death agonies of the coming day, it's as if for a while plague stays its hand and takes breath. All shops are shut. But on some a notice, closed owing to plague, shows that when the others open presently, these will not. Still half asleep, the newsboys do not yet cry the news, but, lounging at street corners, offer their wares to the lampposts, with the vague gestures of sleepwalkers. Soon, awakened by the early streetcars, they will fan out through the town, holding at arm's length sheets on which the word plague looms large. Will there be a plague autumn? Professor B says, no. Toll of the 94th day of plague, 124 deaths. In spite of the growing shortage of paper, which has compelled some dailies to reduce their pages, a new paper has been launched, the Plague Chronicle, which sets out to inform our townspeople with scrupulous veracity of the daily progress or recession of the disease, to supply them with the most authoritative opinions available as to its future course, to offer the hospitality of its columns to all, in whatever walk of life, who wish to join in combating the epidemic, to keep up the morale of the populace, to publish the latest orders issued by the authorities, and to centralize the efforts of all who desire to give active and wholehearted help in the present emergency. Actually, this newspaper very soon came to devote its columns to advertisements of new, infallible, antidotes against plague. Toward 6 in the morning, all these papers are being sold to the lines that begin to form outside the shops over an hour before they open. Then to the passengers alighting from the streetcars coming in, packed to capacity from the suburbs. The cars are now the only means of transport, and they have much difficulty in progressing, what with people standing on the running boards and hanging in clusters from the handrails. A queer thing is how the passengers all try to keep their backs turned to their neighbors, twisting themselves into grotesque attitudes in the attempt, the idea being, of course, to avoid contagion. At every stop, a cataract of men and women is disgorged, each in haste to put a safe distance between himself or herself and the rest. When the first cars have gone by, the town gradually wakes up. Early cafes open their doors, and you see an array of cards on the counter. No coffee, bring your own sugar, and the like. Next, the shops open and the streets grow livelier. And meanwhile, the light is swelling and the sky, even at this early hour, beginning to grow leaden-hued with heat. This is the time when those who have nothing to do venture out on the boulevards. Most of them seem determined to counteract the plague by a lavish display of luxury. Daily, about 11, you see a sort of dress parade of youths and girls who make you realize the frantic desire for life that thrives in the heart of every great calamity. If the epidemic spreads, morals too will broaden, and we may see again the Saturnalia of Milan, men and women dancing round the graves. At noon, in a flash, all the restaurants fill up. Very quickly, small groups of people, unable to find a seat, form at the doors. Because of the intense heat, the sky is losing its brightness. Under big awnings, the aspirants to food wait their turn, aligned along the curbs of streets gaping and sizzling in the fires of noon. The reason for the restaurants being so crowded is that they solve for many the feeding problem, but they do nothing to allay the fear of contagion. Many of the customers spend several minutes methodically wiping their plates. Not long ago, some restaurants put up notices. Our plates, knives, and forks guaranteed sterilized. But gradually they discontinued publicity of this order, since their customers came in any case. People, moreover, spend very freely. Choice wines, or wines alleged to be such. The costliest extras. A mood of reckless extravagance is setting in. It seems that there was something like a panic in a restaurant because a customer suddenly felt ill, went very white, and staggered precipitately to the door. Toward 2 o'clock, the town slowly empties. It's the time when silence, sunlight, dust, and plague have the streets to themselves. Wave after wave of heat flows over the frontage of the tall gray houses during these long, languid hours. Thus the afternoon wears on, slowly merging into an evening that settles down, like a red winding sheet, on the serried tumult of the town. At the start of the great heat, for some unascertained reason, the evenings found the streets almost empty. But now the least ripple of cooler air brings an easing of the strain, if not a flutter of hope. Then all stream out into the open, drug themselves with talking, start arguing or lovemaking, and in the last glow of sunset, the town, freighted with lovers 2 by 2 and loud with voices, drifts like a helmless ship into the throbbing darkness. In vain, a zealous evangelist with a felt hat and flowing tie threads his way through the crowd, crying without cease, "God is great and good. Come unto him." On the contrary, they all make haste toward some trivial objective that seems of more immediate interest than God. In the early days, when they thought this epidemic was much like other epidemics, religion held its ground. But once these people realized their instant peril, they gave their thoughts to pleasure. And all the hideous fears that stamp their faces in the daytime are transformed in the fiery, dusty nightfall into a sort of hectic exultation, an unkempt freedom fevering their blood. And I, too. I'm no different. But what matter? Death means nothing to men like me. It's the event that proves them right. It was Tarou who had asked Rieu for the interview he refers to in his diary. On that evening, as it happened, just before Tarou arrived, the doctor had gazed for some moments at his mother, who was sitting very still in a corner of the dining room. Once her household tasks were over, she spent most of her time in that chair. Her hands folded in her lap, she sat there waiting. Rieu wasn't even sure it was for him she waited. However, something always changed in his mother's face when he came in. The silent resignation that a laborious life had given it seemed to light up with a sudden glow. Then she returned to her tranquility. That evening she was gazing out of the window at the now empty street. The street lighting had been reduced by 2/3, and only at long intervals a lamp cast flickering gleams through the thick darkness of the town. "Will they keep to the reduced lighting as long as the plague lasts?" Madame Rieu asked. "I expect so." "Let's hope it doesn't last till winter. It would be terribly depressing." "Yes," Rieu said. He saw his mother's gaze settle on his forehead. He knew that the worry and overwork of the last few days had scored their traces there. "Didn't things go well today?" his mother asked. "Oh, much as usual." As usual. That was to say, the new consignment of serum sent from Paris seemed less effective than the first, and the death rate was rising. It was still impossible to administer prophylactic inoculations elsewhere than in families already attacked. If its use was to be generalized, very large quantities of the vaccine would have been needed. Most of the buboes refused to burst. It was as if they underwent a seasonal hardening. And the victims suffered horribly. During the last 24 hours, there had been 2 cases of a new form of the epidemic. The plague was becoming pneumonic. On this very day, in the course of a meeting, the much-harassed doctors had pressed the prefect, the unfortunate man seemed quite at his wit's end, to issue new regulations to prevent contagion being carried from mouth to mouth, as happens in pneumonic plague. The prefect had done as they wished, but as usual they were groping more or less in the dark. Looking at his mother, he felt an uprush of a half-forgotten emotion, the love of his boyhood at the sight of her soft brown gaze intent on him. "Don't you ever feel alarmed, mother?" "Oh, at my age there isn't much left to fear. The days are very long, and just now I'm hardly ever at home." "I don't mind waiting, if I know you're going to come back. And when you aren't here, I think of what you're doing. Have you any news?" "Yes, if I'm to believe the last telegram. Everything's going as well as could be expected. But I know she says that to prevent my worrying." The doorbell rang. The doctor gave his mother a smile and went to open the door. In the dim light on the landing, Taru looked like a big gray bear. Ryu gave his visitor a seat facing his desk, while he himself remained standing behind the desk chair. Between them was the only light in the room, a desk lamp. Taru came straight to the point. "I know," he said, "that I can talk to you quite frankly." Ryu nodded. "In a fortnight, or a month at most," Taru continued, "you'll serve no purpose here. Things will have got out of hand." "I agree. The sanitary department is inefficient, understaffed for one thing, and you're worked off your feet." Ryu admitted this was so. "Well," Taru said, "I've heard that the authorities are thinking of a sort of conscription of the population, and all men in good health will be required to help in fighting the plague."
"Your information was correct. But the authorities are in none too good order as it is, and the prefect can't make up his mind."
"If he daren't risk compulsion, why not call for voluntary help?" "It's been done. The response was poor. It was done through official channels, and half-heartedly. What they're short on is imagination. Officialdom can never cope with something really catastrophic. And the remedial measures they think up are hardly adequate for a common cold. If we let them carry on like this, they'll soon be dead, and so shall we." "That's more than likely," Ryu said. "I should tell you, however, that they're thinking of using the prisoners in the jails for what we call the heavy work." "I'd rather free men were employed."
"So would I. But might I ask why you feel like that?"
"I loathe men's being condemned to death."
Ryu looked Taru in the eyes. "So, what?" he asked.
"It's this I have to say. I've drawn up a plan for voluntary groups of helpers. Get me empowered to try out my plan, and then let's sidetrack officialdom. In any case, the authorities have their hands more than full already. I have friends in many walks of life. They'll form a nucleus to start from. And of course, I'll take part in it myself." "I need hardly tell you," Ryu replied, "that I accept your suggestion most gladly. One can't have too many helpers, especially in a job like mine under present conditions. I undertake to get your plan approved by the authorities. Anyhow, they've no choice. But," Ryu pondered, "but I take it, you know that work of this kind may prove fatal to the worker. And I feel I should ask you this. Have you weighed the dangers?" Taru's gray eyes met the doctor's gaze serenely. "What did you think of Panlu's sermon, doctor?" The question was asked in a quite ordinary tone, and Ryu answered in the same tone. "I've seen too much of hospitals to relish any idea of collective punishment. But as you know, Christians sometimes say this sort of thing without really thinking it. They're better than they seem. However, you think, like Panlu, that the plague has its good side? It opens men's eyes and forces them to take thought?" The doctor tossed his head impatiently.
"So does every ill that flesh is heir to.
What's true of all the evils in the world is true of plague as well. It helps men to rise above themselves. All the same, when you see the misery it brings, You'd need to be a madman or a coward or stone blind to give in tamely to the plague.
Ryu had hardly raised his voice at all, but Teru made a slight gesture as if to calm him.
He was smiling.
Yes, Ryu shrugged his shoulders. But you haven't answered my question yet. Have you weighed the consequences?
Teru squared his shoulders against the back of the chair, then moved his head forward into the light. Do you believe in God, Doctor? Again the question was put in an ordinary tone. But this time, Ryu took longer to find his answer.
No. But what does that really mean? I'm fumbling in the dark, struggling to make something out. But I've long ceased finding that original.
Isn't that it? The gulf between Panlu and you?
I doubt it. Panlu is a man of learning, a scholar. He hasn't come in contact with death. That's why he can speak with such assurance of the truth, with a capital T. But every country priest who visits his parishioners and has heard a man gasping for breath on his deathbed thinks as I do. He'd try to relieve human suffering before trying to point out its excellence. Ryu stood up. His face was now in shadow.
Let's drop the subject, he said.
As you won't answer.
Teru remained seated in his chair. He was smiling again. Suppose I answer with a question.
The doctor now smiled too.
You like being mysterious, don't you?
Yes, fire away.
My question's this, said Teru. Why do you yourself show such devotion, considering you don't believe in God? I suspect your answer may help me to mine.
His face still in shadow, Ryu said that he'd already answered. That if he believed in an all-powerful God, he would cease curing the sick and leave that to him. But no one in the world believed in a God of that sort. No, not even Panlu, who believed that he believed in such a God. And this was proved by the fact that no one ever threw himself on Providence completely. Anyhow, in this respect, Ryu believed himself to be on the right road. In fighting against creation as he found it.
Ah, Teru remarked. So that's the idea you have of your profession?
More or less. The doctor came back into the light.
Teru made a faint whistling noise with his lips, and the doctor gazed at him.
Yes, you're thinking it calls for pride to feel that way. But I assure you I've no more than the pride that's needed to keep me going. I have no idea what's awaiting me, or what'll happen when all this ends. For the moment I know this. There are sick people, and they need curing. Later on, perhaps, they'll think things over, and so shall I. But what's wanted now is to make them well. I defend them as best I can, that's all.
Against whom?
Ryu turned to the window. A shadow line on the horizon told of the presence of the sea.
He was conscious only of his exhaustion, and at the same time was struggling against a sudden, irrational impulse to unburden himself a little more to his companion. An eccentric, perhaps, but who, he guessed, was one of his own kind.
I haven't a notion, Teru. I assure you, I haven't a notion. When I entered this profession, I did it abstractedly, so to speak. Because I had a desire for it, because it meant a career like another, one that young men often aspire to. Perhaps, too, because it was particularly difficult for a workman's son like myself. And then I had to see people die.
Do you know that there are some who refuse to die? Have you ever heard a woman scream, "Never!" with her last gasp?
Well, I have. And then I saw that I could never get hardened to it. I was young then, and I was outraged by the whole scheme of things, or so I thought. Subsequently, I grew more modest. Only, I've never managed to get used to seeing people die. That's all I know. Yes, after all. Ryu fell silent and sat down. He felt his mouth dry. After all? Teru prompted softly. After all, the doctor repeated, then hesitated again, fixing his eyes on Teru. It's something that a man of your sort can understand most likely, but since the order of the world is shaped by death, mightn't it be better for God if we refuse to believe in him and struggle with all our might against death, without raising our eyes toward the heaven where he sits in silence? Teru nodded. Yes, but your victories will never be lasting, that's all. Ryu's face darkened. Yes, I know that. But it's no reason for giving up the struggle. No reason, I agree. Only I now can picture what this plague must mean for you. Yes, a never-ending defeat. Teru stared at the doctor for a moment, then turned and tramped heavily toward the door. Ryu followed him and was almost at his side when Teru, who was staring at the floor, suddenly said, "Who taught you all this, doctor?" The reply came promptly. Suffering. Ryu opened the door of his surgery and told Teru that he too was going out. He had a patient to visit in the suburbs. Teru suggested they should go together, and he agreed. In the hall, they encountered Madame Ryu, and the doctor introduced Teru to her. "A friend of mine," he said. "Indeed," said Madame Ryu. "I'm very pleased to make your acquaintance." When she left them, Teru turned to gaze after her. On the landing, the doctor pressed a switch to turn on the lights along the stairs. But the stairs remained in darkness. Possibly some new light-saving order had come into force. Really, however, there was no knowing. For some time past, in the streets no less than in private houses, everything had been going out of order. It might be only that the concierge, like nearly everyone in the town, was ceasing to bother about his duties. The doctor had no time to follow up his thoughts. Teru's voice came from behind him. "Just one word more, doctor, even if it sounds to you a bit nonsensical." "You're perfectly right." The doctor merely gave a little shrug, unseen in the darkness. "To tell the truth, all that's outside my range. But you, what do you know about it?" "Ah," Teru replied quite coolly. "I've little left to learn." Ryu paused, and behind him, Teru's foot slipped on a step. He steadied himself by gripping the doctor's shoulder. "Do you really imagine you know everything about life?" The answer came through the darkness in the same cool, confident tone. "Yes." Once in the street, they realized it must be quite late. 11, perhaps. All was silence in the town, except for some vague rustlings. An ambulance bell clanged faintly in the distance. They stepped into the car, and Ryu started the engine. "You must come to the hospital tomorrow," he said, "for an injection. But before embarking on this adventure, you'd better know your chances of coming out of it alive. They're 1 in 3. "That sort of reckoning doesn't hold water. You know it, doctor, as well as I. 100 years ago, plague wiped out the entire population of a town in Persia, with one exception. And the sole survivor was precisely the man whose job it was to wash the dead bodies, and who carried on throughout the epidemic. He pulled off his 1 in 3 chance, that's all." Ryu had lowered his voice. "But you're right. We know next to nothing on the subject." They were entering the suburbs. The headlights lit up empty streets. The car stopped. Standing in front of it, Ryu asked Teru if he'd like to come in. Teru said, "Yes." A glimmer of light from the sky lit up their faces. Suddenly, Ryu gave a short laugh, and there was much friendliness in it. "Out with it, Teru. What on earth prompted you to take a hand in this?
I don't know. My code of morals, perhaps.
Your code of morals? What code?
Comprehension.
Teru turned toward the house, and Ryu didn't see his face again until they were in the old asthma patient's room.
Next day, Teru set to work and enrolled a first team of workers, soon to be followed by many others. However, it's not the narrator's intention to ascribe to these sanitary groups more importance than their due. Doubtless, today, many of our fellow citizens are apt to yield to the temptation of exaggerating the services they rendered. But the narrator is inclined to think that, by attributing overimportance to praiseworthy actions, one may, by implication, be paying indirect but potent homage to the worst side of human nature. For this attitude implies that such actions shine out as rare exceptions, while callousness and apathy are the general rule. The narrator doesn't share that view. The evil that's in the world always comes of ignorance, and good intentions may do as much harm as malevolence, if they lack understanding. On the whole, men are more good than bad. That, however, isn't the real point. But they are more or less ignorant, and it's this that we call vice or virtue. The most incorrigible vice being that of an ignorance that fancies it knows everything and therefore claims for itself the right to kill. The soul of the murderer is blind. And there can be no true goodness nor true love without the utmost clear-sightedness. Hence the sanitary groups, whose creation was entirely Teru's work, should be considered with objectivity as well as with approval. And this is why the narrator declines to vaunt in over-glowing terms a courage and a devotion to which he attributes only a relative and reasonable importance. But he will continue being the chronicler of the troubled, rebellious hearts of our townspeople under the impact of the plague. Those who enrolled in the sanitary squads, as they were called, had indeed no such great merit in doing as they did, since they knew it was the only thing to do, and the unthinkable thing would then have been not to have brought themselves to do it. These groups enabled our townsfolk to come to grips with the disease and convince them that, now that plague was among us, it was up to them to do whatever could be done to fight it. Since plague became in this way some men's duty, it revealed itself as what it really was. That is the concern of all. So far, so good. But we don't congratulate a schoolmaster on teaching that 2 and 2 make 4, though we may, perhaps, congratulate him on having chosen his laudable vocation. Let's then say it was praiseworthy that Teru and so many others should have elected to prove that 2 and 2 make 4, rather than the contrary. But let's add that this good will of theirs was one that's shared by the schoolmaster and by all who have the same feelings as the schoolmaster. And, be it said to the credit of mankind, they are more numerous than one would think. Such, anyhow, is the narrator's conviction. Needless to say, he can see quite clearly a point that could be made against him, which is that these men were risking their lives. But again and again, there comes a time in history when the man who dares to say that 2 and 2 make 4 is punished with death. The schoolteacher is well aware of this. And the question is not one of knowing what punishment or reward attends the making of this calculation. The question is that of knowing whether 2 and 2 do make 4. For those of our townsfolk who risk their lives in this predicament, the issue was whether or not plague was in their midst, and whether or not they must fight against it. Many fledgling moralists in those days were going about our town proclaiming there was nothing to be done about it, and we should bow to the inevitable. And Teru, Ryu, and their friends might give one answer or another, but its conclusion was always the same. Their certitude that a fight must be put up, in this way or that, and there must be no bowing down. The essential thing was to save the greatest possible number of persons from dying and being doomed to unending separation. And to do this, there was only one resource: to fight the plague. There was nothing admirable about this attitude. It was merely logical. Thus, it was only natural that old Dr. Castell should plod away with unshaken confidence, never sparing himself, at making anti-plague serum on the spot with the makeshift equipment at his disposal. Ryu shared his hope that a vaccine made with cultures of the bacilli, obtained locally, would take effect more actively than serum coming from outside, since the local bacillus differed slightly from the normal plague bacillus as defined in textbooks of tropical diseases. And Castell expected to have his first supply ready within a surprisingly short period. That, too, is why it was natural that Gron, who had nothing of the hero about him, should now be acting as a sort of general secretary to the sanitary squads. A certain number of the groups organized by Taru were working in the congested areas of the town, with a view to improving the sanitary conditions there. Their duties were to see that houses were kept in a proper hygienic state, and to list attics and cellars that had not been disinfected by the official sanitary service. Other teams of volunteers accompanied the doctors on their house-to-house visits, saw to the evacuation of infected persons, and subsequently, owing to the shortage of drivers, even drove the vehicles conveying sick persons and dead bodies. All this involved the upkeep of registers and statistics, and Gron undertook the task. From this angle, the narrator holds that, more than Ryu or Taru, Gron was the true embodiment of the quiet courage that inspired the sanitary groups. He had said yes without a moment's hesitation, and with the large-heartedness that was a second nature with him. All he had asked was to be allotted light duties. He was too old for anything else. He could give his time from 6 to 8 every evening. When Ryu thanked him with some warmth, he seemed surprised. "Why, that's not difficult. Plague is here and we've got to make a stand, that's obvious. Ah, I only wish everything were as simple." And he went back to his phrase. Sometimes in the evening, when he had filed his reports and worked out his statistics, Gron and Ryu would have a chat. Soon they formed the habit of including Taru in their talks, and Gron unburdened himself with increasingly apparent pleasure to his two companions. They began to take a genuine interest in the laborious literary task to which he was applying himself, while plague raged around him. Indeed, they too found in it a relaxation of the strain. "How's your young lady on horseback progressing?" Taru would ask. And invariably, Gron would answer with a wry smile, "Trotting along, trotting along." One evening, Gron announced that he had definitely discarded the adjective elegant for his horsewoman. From now on, it was replaced by slim. "That's more concrete," he explained. Soon after, he read out to his two friends the new version of the sentence. "One fine morning in May, a slim young horsewoman might have been seen riding a handsome sorrel mare along the flowery avenues of the Bois de Boulogne." "Don't you agree with me? One sees her better that way?" "And I put, one fine morning in May, because in the month of May tended rather to drag out the trot, if you see what I mean." Next he showed some anxiety about the adjective handsome. In his opinion, it didn't convey enough, and he set to looking for an epithet that would promptly and clearly photograph the superb animal he saw with his mind's eye. Plump wouldn't do. Though concrete enough, it sounded perhaps a little disparaging, also a shade vulgar. Beautifully groomed had tempted him for a moment, but it was cumbrous and made the rhythm limp somewhat. Then one evening he announced triumphantly that he had got it. A black sorrel mare. To his thinking, he explained, black conveyed a hint of elegance and opulence.
It won't do, Ryu said.
Why not?
Because sorrel doesn't mean a breed of horse. It's a color.
What color?
Well, a color that anyhow isn't black.
Gron seemed greatly troubled.
Thank you, he said warmly. How fortunate you're here to help me. But you see how difficult it is.
How about glossy? Taru suggested.
Gron gazed at him meditatively. Then, yes, he exclaimed. That's good.
And slowly his lips parted in a smile.
Some days later, he confessed that the word flowery was bothering him considerably. As the only towns he knew were Oran and Montélimar, he sometimes asked his friends to tell him about the avenues of the Bois de Boulogne, what sort of flowers grew in them and how they were disposed. Actually, neither Rieu nor Taru had ever gathered the impression that those avenues were flowery. But Gron's conviction on the subject shook their confidence in their memories. He was amazed at their uncertainty.
It's only artists who know how to use their eyes, was his conclusion.
But one evening the doctor found him in a state of much excitement. For flowery, he had substituted flower strewn. He was rubbing his hands.
At last one can see them, smell them.
Hats off, gentlemen. Triumphantly he read out the sentence.
One fine morning in May, a slim young horsewoman might have been seen riding a glossy sorrel mare along the flower-strewn avenues of the Bois de Boulogne. But spoken aloud, the numerous S sounds had a disagreeable effect, and Gron stumbled over them, lisping here and there.
He sat down, crestfallen. Then he asked the doctor if he might go. Some hard thinking lay ahead of him. It was about this time, as was subsequently learned, that he began to display signs of absent-mindedness in the office. A serious view was taken of these lapses of attention, as the municipality not only was working at high pressure with reduced staff, but was constantly having new duties thrust upon it. His department suffered, and his chief took him severely to task, pointing out that he was paid to do certain work, and was failing to do it as it should be done.
I am told that you are acting as a voluntary helper in the sanitary groups. You do this out of office hours, so it's no concern of mine. But the best way of making yourself useful in a terrible time like this is to do your work well. Otherwise, all the rest is useless.
He's right, Gron said to Ryu.
Yes, he's right, the doctor agreed.
But I can't steady my thoughts. It's the end of my phrase that's worrying me. I don't seem able to sort it out.
The plethora of sibilants in the sentence still offended his ear, but he saw no way of amending them without using what were, to his mind, inferior synonyms. And that flower strewn, which had rejoiced him when he first lit on it, now seemed unsatisfactory. How could one say the flowers were strewn, when presumably they had been planted along the avenues, or else grew there naturally? On some evenings, indeed, he looked more tired than Ryu. Yes, this unavailing quest which never left his mind had worn him out. Nonetheless, he went on adding up the figures and compiling the statistics needed for the sanitary groups. Patiently, every evening he brought his totals up to date, illustrated them with graphs, and racked his brains to present his data in the most exact, clearest form. Quite often he went to see Ryu at one of the hospitals and asked to be given a table in an office or the dispensary. He would settle down at it with his papers, exactly as he settled down at his desk in the municipal office, and wave each completed sheet to dry the ink in the warm air, noisome with disinfectants and the disease itself. At these times, he made honest efforts not to think about his horsewoman and concentrate on what he had to do. Yes, if it's a fact that people like to have examples given them, men of the type they call heroic, and if it's absolutely necessary that this narrative should include a hero, the narrator commends to his readers, with, to his thinking, perfect justice, this insignificant and obscure hero who had to his credit only a little goodness of heart and a seemingly absurd ideal. This will render to the truth its due, to the addition of two and two its sum of four, and to heroism the secondary place that rightly falls to it, just after, never before, the noble claim of happiness. It will also give this chronicle its character, which is intended to be that of a narrative made with good feelings. That is to say, feelings that are neither demonstrably bad, nor overcharged with emotion in the ugly manner of a stage play. Such at least was Dr. Ryu's opinion when he read in newspapers or heard on the radio the messages and encouragement the outer world transmitted to the plague-ridden populace. Besides the comfort sent by air or overland, compassionate or admiring comments were lavished on the henceforth isolated town by way of newspaper articles or broadcast talks. And invariably, their epical or prize speech verbiage jarred on the doctor. Needless to say, he knew the sympathy was genuine enough, but it could be expressed only in the conventional language with which men try to express what unites them with mankind in general. A vocabulary quite unsuited, for example, to Grand's small daily effort, and incapable of describing what Grand stood for under plague conditions. Sometimes at midnight, in the great silence of the sleep-bound town, the doctor turned on his radio before going to bed for the few hours' sleep he allowed himself. And from the ends of the earth, across thousands of miles of land and sea, kindly, well-meaning speakers tried to voice their fellow feeling, and indeed did so, but at the same time proved the utter incapacity of every man truly to share in suffering that he can't see. Oran, Oran. In vain the call rang over oceans. In vain Ryu listened hopefully. Always the tide of eloquence began to flow, bringing home still more the unbridgeable gulf that lay between Gron and the speaker. Oran, we're with you, they called emotionally, but not, the doctor told himself, to love or to die together. And that's the only way. They're too remote. And, as it so happens, what is yet to be recorded before coming to the culmination, during the period when the plague was gathering all its forces to fling them at the town and lay it waste, is the long, heart-rendingly monotonous struggle put up by some obstinate people like Rambert to recover their lost happiness and to balk the plague of that part of themselves which they were ready to defend in the last ditch. This was their way of resisting the bondage closing in upon them. And while their resistance lacked the active virtues of the other, it had, to the narrator's thinking, its point. And moreover, it bore witness, even in its futility and incoherences, to a salutary pride. Rambert fought to prevent the plague from besting him. Once assured that there was no way of getting out of the town by lawful methods, he decided, as he told Ryu, to have recourse to others. He began by sounding café waiters. A waiter usually knows much of what's going on behind the scenes. But the first he spoke to knew only of the very heavy penalties imposed on such attempts at evasion. In one of the cafés he visited, he was actually taken for a stool pigeon and curtly sent about his business. It wasn't until he happened to meet Cottard at Ryu's place that he made a little headway. On that day, he and Ryu had been talking again about his unsuccessful efforts to interest the authorities in his case, and Cottard heard the tail end of the conversation. Some days later, Kotar met him in the street and greeted him with the hail fellow well-met manner that he now used on all occasions.
Hello, Rambert. Still no luck?
None whatever.
It's no good counting on the red tape merchants. They couldn't understand if they tried.
I know that. And I'm trying to find some other way. But it's damn difficult.
Yes, Kotar replied. It certainly is.
He, however, knew a way to go about it. And he explained to Rambert, who was much surprised to learn this, that for some time past he had been going the rounds of the cafes, had made a number of acquaintances, and had learned of the existence of an organization handling this sort of business. The truth was that Kotar, who had been beginning to live above his means, was now involved in smuggling ventures concerned with rationed goods. Selling contraband cigarettes and inferior liquor at steadily rising prices, he was on the way to building up a small fortune.
Are you quite sure of this? Rambert asked.
Quite. I had a proposal of the sort made to me the other day.
But you didn't accept it.
Oh, come. There's no need to be suspicious. Kotar's tone was genial. I didn't accept it because, personally, I've no wish to leave.
I have my reasons.
After a short silence, he added,
You don't ask me what my reasons are, I notice.
I take it, Rambert replied, that they're none of my business.
That's so, in a way, of course. But from another angle, well, let's put it like this. I've been feeling much more at ease here since plague settled in.
Rambert made no comment. Then he asked,
And how does one approach this organization, as you call it?
Ah, Kotar replied. That's none too easy.
Come with me.
It was 4 in the afternoon. The town was warming up to boiling point under a sultry sky. Nobody was about. All shops were shuttered. Kotar and Rambert walked some distance without speaking, under the arcades. This was an hour of the day when the plague lay low, so to speak. The silence, the extinction of all color and movement, might have been due as much to the fierce sunlight as to the epidemic. And there was no telling if the air was heavy with menace or merely with dust and heat. You had to look closely and take thought to realize that plague was here. For it betrayed its presence only by negative signs. Thus Kotar, who had affinities with it, drew Rambert's attention to the absence of the dogs, that in normal times would have been seen sprawling in the shadow of the doorways, panting, trying to find a non-existent patch of coolness. They went along the Boulevard des Palmiers, crossed the Place d'Armes, and then turned down toward the docks. On the left was a café painted green, with a wide awning of coarse yellow canvas projecting over the sidewalk. Kotar and Rambert wiped their brows on entering. There were some small iron tables, also painted green, and folding chairs. The room was empty, the air humming with flies. In a yellow cage on the bar, a parrot squatted on its perch, all its feathers drooping. Some old pictures of military scenes, covered with grime and cobwebs, adorned the walls. On the tables, including that at which Rambert was sitting, bird droppings were drying, and he was puzzled whence they came until, after some wing flappings, a handsome cock came hopping out of his retreat in a dark corner. Just then the heat seemed to rise several degrees more. Kotar took off his coat and banged on the tabletop. A very small man, wearing a long blue apron that came nearly to his neck, emerged from a doorway at the back, shouted a greeting to Kotar, and, vigorously kicking the cock out of his way, came up to the table. Raising his voice to drown the cock's indignant cacklings, he asked what the gentleman would like. Kotar ordered white wine and asked,
"Where's Garcia?"
The dwarf replied that he'd not shown up at the café for several days.
Think he'll come this evening?
Well, I ain't in his secrets. But you know when he usually comes, don't you?
Yes.
Really, it's nothing very urgent. I only want him to know this friend of mine.
The barkeeper rubbed his moist hands on the front of his apron.
Ah, so this gentleman's in business too?
Yes, Kotar said. The little man made a snuffling noise.
All right, come back this evening. I'll send the kid to warn him.
After they had left, Rambert asked what the business in question might be.
Why, smuggling, of course. They get the stuff in past the sentries at the gates. There's plenty money in it.
I see. Rambert paused for a moment, then asked, And I take it, they friends in court?
You've said it.
In the evening, the awning was rolled up, the parrot squawking in its cage, and the small tables were surrounded by men in their shirt sleeves. When Kotar entered, one man, with a white shirt gaping on a brick-red chest and a straw hat planted well back on his head, rose to his feet. He had a sun-tanned face, regular features, small black eyes, very white teeth, and two or three rings on his fingers. He looked about 30.
Hi, he said to Kotar, ignoring Rambert. Let's have one at the bar.
They drank three rounds in silence.
How about a stroll? Garcia suggested.
They walked toward the harbor. Garcia asked what he was wanted to do. Kotar explained that it wasn't really for a deal that he wanted to introduce his friend, Monsieur Rambert, but only for what he called a getaway. Puffing at his cigarette, Garcia walked straight ahead. He asked some questions, always referring to Rambert as he, and appearing not to notice his presence.
Why does he want to go?
His wife is in France.
Ah.
After a short pause, he added, What's his job?
He's a journalist.
Is he now?
Journalists have long tongues.
I told you, he's a friend of mine, Kotar replied.
They walked on in silence until they were near the wharves, which were now railed off. Then they turned in the direction of a small tavern from which came a smell of fried sardines.
In any case, Garcia said finally, it's not up my alley. Raoul's your man, and I'll have to get in touch with him. It's none too easy.
That's so.
Kotar sounded interested.
He's lying low, is he?
Garcia made no answer. At the door of the tavern he halted and for the first time addressed Rambert directly. The day after tomorrow at 11, at the corner of the customs barracks in the upper town. He made as if to go, then seemed to have an afterthought. It's going to cost something, you know. He made the observation in a quite casual tone. Rambert nodded.
Naturally.
On the way back, the journalist thanked Kotar.
Don't mention it, old chap. I'm only too glad to help you.
And then, you're a journalist. I dare say you'll put in a word for me one day or another.
2 days later, Rambert and Kotar climbed the wide, shadeless street leading to the upper part of the town. The barracks occupied by the customs officers had been partly transformed into a hospital, and a number of people were standing outside the main entrance, some of them hoping to be allowed to visit a patient. A futile hope, since such visits were strictly prohibited, and others to glean some news of an invalid, news that in the course of an hour would have ceased to count. For these reasons, there were always a number of people and a certain amount of movement at this spot, a fact that probably accounted for its choice by Garcia for his meeting with Rambert.
It puzzles me, Kotar remarked, why you're so keen on going.
Really, what's happening here is extremely interesting.
Not to me, Rambert replied.
Well, yes, one's running some risks, I grant you.
All the same, when you come to think of it, one ran quite as much risk in the old days, crossing a busy street.
Just then, Ryu's car drew up level with them. Taru was at the wheel, and Ryu seemed half asleep. He roused himself to make the introductions.
We know each other, Taru said. We're at the same hotel.
He then offered to drive Rambert back to the center.
No, thanks. We've an appointment here.
Ryu looked hard at Rambert.
Yes, Rambert said.
What's that? Kotar sounded surprised. The doctor knows about it?
There's the magistrate.
Taru gave Kotar a warning glance. Kotar's look changed. Monsieur Othon was striding down the street toward them, briskly, yet with dignity. He took off his hat as he came up with them.
Good morning, Monsieur Othon, said Taru.
The magistrate returned the greeting of the man in the car and, turning to Rambert and Kotar, who were in the background, gave them a quiet nod. Taru introduced Kotar and the journalist. The magistrate gazed at the sky for a moment, sighed, and remarked that these were indeed sad times.
I've been told, Monsieur Taru, he continued, that you are helping to enforce the prophylactic measures. I need hardly say how commendable that is. A fine example. Do you think, Dr. Ryu, that the epidemic will get worse? Ryu replied that one could only hope it wouldn't. And the magistrate replied that one must never lose hope. The ways of Providence were inscrutable.
Taru asked if his work had increased as the result of present conditions.
Quite the contrary. Criminal cases of what we call the first instance are growing rarer. In fact, almost my only work just now is holding inquiries into more serious breaches of the new regulations. Our ordinary laws have never been so well respected.
That's because, by contrast, they necessarily appear good ones, Taru observed.
The magistrate, who seemed unable to take his gaze off the sky, abruptly dropped his mildly meditative air and stared at Taru.
What does that matter? It's not the law that counts, it's the sentence. And that's something we must all accept.
That fellow, said Taru when the magistrate was out of hearing, is enemy number one.
He pressed the starter. Some minutes later, Rambert and Kotar saw Garcia approaching. Without making any sign of recognition, he came straight up to them and, by way of greeting, said,
You'll have to wait a bit.
There was complete silence in the crowd around them, most of whom were women. Nearly all were carrying parcels. They had the vain hope of somehow smuggling these in to their sick relatives, and the even crazier idea that the latter could eat the food they'd brought. The gate was guarded by armed sentries, and now and then an eerie cry resounded in the courtyard between the barrack rooms and the entrance. Whenever this happened, anxious eyes turned toward the sick wards. The three men were watching the scene when a brisk, "Good morning," from behind them made them swing round. In spite of the heat, Raoul was wearing a well-cut dark suit and a felt hat with rolled-up brim. He was tall and strongly built, his face rather pale. Hardly moving his lips, he said quickly and clearly, "Let's walk down to the center. You, Garcia, needn't come."
Garcia lit a cigarette and remained there while they walked away.
Placing himself between Rambert and Kotar, Raoul set the pace, a fast one.
Garcia's explained the situation, he said. We can fix it, but I must warn you it'll cost you a cool 10,000.
Rambert said he agreed to these terms. Lunch with me tomorrow at the Spanish restaurant near the docks. Rambert said, right, and Raoul shook his hand, smiling for the first time. After he had gone, Kotar said he wouldn't be able to come to lunch next day, as he had an engagement. But anyhow, Rambert didn't need him anymore. When next day Rambert entered the Spanish restaurant, everyone turned and stared at him. The dark, cellar-like room below the level of the small yellow street was patronized only by men, mostly Spaniards, judging by their looks. Raoul was sitting at a table at the back of the room. Once he had beckoned to the journalist, and Rambert started to go toward him, the curiosity left the faces of others, and they bent over their plates again. Raoul had beside him a tall, thin, ill-shaven man with enormously wide shoulders, an equine face, and thinning hair. His shirt sleeves were rolled up, displaying long, skinny arms covered with black hair. When Rambert was introduced, he gave three slow nods. His own name, however, wasn't announced, and Raoul,
when referring to him, always said, "Our friend."
"Our friend here thinks he may be able to help you."
"He's going," Raoul broke off, as the